Last month, I had the joy of starting a class here at church. It is called Popcorn Theology, and we are watching films with spiritual and philosophical meaning and then discussing them. The first one that we watched was called A Serious Man, which it's a Coen Brothers film from 2009. And this is how one reviewer describes this dark comedy. It's 1967 in Minnesota, and life is getting more and more difficult for physics professor Larry Gopnik. Despite his best efforts to be a good man, a respected member of the Jewish community, a bona fide mensch, the structure of his life is collapsing like the walls of Jericho. Larry's son Danny is a Hebrew school screw-up with a strong taste for pot. His brother Arthur, a once brilliant mathematician, monopolizes the lone bathroom to drain the pus from his infected boils. And Larry's wife Judith announces suddenly that she wants a divorce. She has fallen in love with a wealthy widower who, in Judith's eyes, possesses the gravitas that Larry lacks. Thus, Larry's life is slowly coming to pieces, and by the middle of the film, it is as though he is sitting on a trash heap of epic proportions. Now, here is another very different film. It came out just 2 years after A Serious Man. It is Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. As one reviewer puts it, the film's portrait of everyday life is bounded by two immensities, one of space and time, and the other of spirituality. The Tree of Life has awe-inspiring visuals of the birth and expansion of the universe, the appearance of life on a microscopic level, and the evolution of species. It features dinosaurs walking the earth, and then, in later visuals, the remnants of dinosaur bones that have been fossilized and preserved for millions of years, just like the skull of our dinosaur friend here in the service. The Tree of Life intersperses these epic images with the ordinary images of a 1950s family, suggesting in poetic flourish the trials and struggles of a particular family as it is dwarfed, held, and folded into the immensity of existence. These two films, A Serious Man and The Tree of Life, have very little in common. They could not be more different in genre or storyline. One is an acerbic comedy about a sad sack professor and his pot-smoking teen, while the other is a serious poetic drama interspersed with images of cosmic grandeur. But what links the two films is hinted at in the line that appears before the beginning of The Tree of Life. Before any of the majestic or ordinary scenes are offered, there is an epigraph which reads, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" This, of course, is a line from the book of Job when God speaks from the whirlwind. In other words, both A Serious Man and The Tree of Life are reinterpretations and retellings of the book of Job. Now, the fact that the same piece of writing could produce such divergent adaptations testifies to its power. The University of California Berkeley scholar Robert Alter would agree with that. He calls the Book of Job one of the greatest poems ever written with unparalleled linguistic originality. He goes so far as to suggest that perhaps it is precisely because of its poetic brilliance that Job made it into the canon at all. Indeed, Job's book is not an easy fit because it portrays God and humanity and suffering in a very different light than most of the rest of the Hebrew scriptures. The central part of the book of Job was written while the Jewish people were exiled in Babylon. much of the writing from this period, especially the writing of the prophets, fits within the traditional frame of suffering as punishment. It said that God was punishing the Hebrew people for their disobedience, for turning away from God. As Jeremiah put it, the Jewish people have returned to the errors of their forefathers of old and refused to heed God's word. His is a clear understanding of suffering that results from disobedience. The author of Job was writing during this same time, and he must have heard from many people around him that the suffering inflicted on the Jewish community was the result of its own sin, and that they had brought it on themselves. But the poem rejects this view. It's fascinating. The poem was apparently so troubling in its original form that later readers added a frame around it, an introduction and a conclusion that would make it more theologically acceptable. This is because rather than giving neat platitudes about God's goodness, the central part of the book rejects such explanations with ferocity. Indeed, the book of Job contains the most eloquent passages ever penned of its title character cursing his life, creation, and rejecting rationales for God's justice. Job cries out, "Annul the day that I was born, and the night which said a child is conceived. That day, let there be darkness." Not only does he curse the very day of his birth, but he curses his conception. Thus begins his long litany of epithets against life and against God. Now, as Job sits on a trash heap and picks at the boils that have been inflicted upon him, his friends come to join him. They bristle at Job's blasphemy, and they proffer easy advice that exonerates God. They insist that Job's suffering must be his punishment, and thus engage in an elaborate game of victim blaming. His friend Zophar interjects that God must see faults that Job has missed, saying, "If only God would open his lips against you, how do you know what God has probed that you have missed about your own behavior?" Eliphaz is even more blunt, saying, "Friend, your evil is great. There is no end to your crimes." But Job rejects this, insisting that he is blameless and that it is God's judgment that has gone amiss. But Bildad differs, saying, "How long will you jabber about such things? Would God pervert justice?" Presumably, the answer is supposed to be no, and Job is supposed to accept his fault and punishment. But ultimately, Job doesn't. Instead, he maintains his resolve and rejects his friend's advice as proverbs of ashes. Proverbs of ashes. Now, it's a shame, I think, that worthless proverbs and facile platitudes aren't limited to Job's times. The writer and scholar of religion, Kate Bowler, wrote in a New York Times op-ed about her cancer diagnosis. And this is what she says. "After I had been diagnosed with cancer, a neighbor knocked on our door to tell my husband that everything happens for a reason. I'd love to hear it, my husband said. Pardon? My neighbor said, stunned. I'd love to hear the reason that my wife is dying." This is what he said in that sweet and sour way that he has. Bowler continues, "Now, my neighbor wasn't doing anything malicious. She wanted to fill that silence around why some people die young and others grow old and fussy about their lawns. She wanted some kind of order behind all of the chaos, because people can't quite let themselves just say it, 'Wow, that's awful, or there are just no words for this. Instead, they try to make it okay by explaining it. They think that there has to be a reason, because without one, we are left as helpless and possibly as unlucky as everyone else. Now, at the end of Job's story, a voice comes from the whirlwind. And this is the part that any attentive reader would eagerly anticipate, hoping for some good news after his friend's terrible advice. But the whirlwind does not give a rationale for life's hardships. It actually doesn't address good or evil or suffering at all. Instead, it shifts the conversation to thinking about from thinking about our narrow human understanding of suffering and desperately trying to come up with an answer for it, and invites us instead to understand ourselves within the larger context of existence. Against Job's friends who insist that Job has brought this suffering on himself, against tidy theological explanations that lay blame or that claim that there's a reason for everything, the whirlwind offers images of immensity. It implores, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Do you know the mountain goat's birth time? Who set the wild donkey free? Do you give might to the horse? By your word, does the eagle mount and set his nest on high?" The language is stunning, dazzling, beautiful, even if, as an answer to suffering, it remains elliptical. I'm afraid Job's friends, and Kate Bowler's neighbor for that matter, would hardly find them satisfying. Job's whirlwind says that at the end of the day, we just don't know. It's all too big. It's better for you to stand back and breathe it in rather than trying to contain it and insist on an answer. The liberation theologian Gustavo Gutierrez summarizes it this way, saying that Job is invited to leap the fence set around him by his own narrow theology and ideology, to breathe an unrestricted air like the animals described by the whirlwind, animals that humans cannot domesticate. The world outside of this fence is the world of gratuitousness, immensity, wildness. Oh, human, won't you join that? In a way, I appreciate that advice. And we have such a great example of why we might appreciate it here in our sanctuary today. When I look at something as incredible and majestic as this dinosaur, who has been my preaching companion for 2 weeks now, when I think about the contours of her bones and the way that she roamed the earth 67 million years ago, when I think about the complexity of life that led from the most microscopic levels of existence to her own life, and then on and on and on to my own life, I am left in complete and utter awe. My own troubles seem dwarfed. And perhaps through that experience, there is some invitation of value here, some invitation to look beyond the narrow limits of my own life to something that is greater, wilder, more gratuitous, and more mysterious than anything I can quite lay my finger on. Perhaps, just maybe, in that immensity, suffering may become a little bit less all-consuming. It's a lot like the advice that one of my therapist friends once mentioned to me. She said that if a painful emotional feeling occurs, she often tells her clients to try to imagine where it is located in their body. Perhaps anger is in your chest, or anxiety is in your stomach. If those feelings seem overpowering and threatening, she says, try to imagine a bigger container to hold them. Try to imagine your body as a bigger container that can hold them. By doing that, it releases some of the constriction that we have around that experiences, it might just allow us to relax a little bit, to find ease, to have the suffering become a little bit less all-consuming. Job, by pointing to the universe itself, suggests the biggest container for suffering imaginable, dispersing its intensity into a universal enormousness. Now, I want to add before finishing that I'm not completely sold on this understanding. There can be something crass in reducing the problem of suffering to a confident assertion of, yep, life sure is big, isn't it? And there will be times when the words of the whirlwind are ludicrous and insensitive to offer in the context of your own or someone else's suffering. I believe it would be wholly inappropriate to foist that explanation onto someone else's broken heart. Sometimes the best words for suffering are simply, there are no words. But if we let all of this be, instead of a rigid assertion, a gentle invitation, we may find something helpful, even comforting. There is wisdom in peeking beyond our own narrow condition. Some modest piece of good news is contained in this idea that whatever suffering we are experiencing, whatever injustice and hardship we face, life rushes on, creation continues to unfold, and a breathtaking immensity is always opening itself as an invitation to us, before us, encircling us, holding us. To paraphrase the Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shihab Nye, what a small flicker is given for each of us to know. For a second, I am comforted by the Milky Way made of more stars than any naked eye can count. And in that truth, may we find some inscription of hope. My spiritual companions, amen. I love you, and blessed be.